Obama called Wright. I was at Amherst College in the office of Paul Sorrentino, the director of religious life there, when Barack called, Wright told me. Barack said, Rev, David Axelrod is going to call you, because we're going to Iowa tomorrow, and I don't want you to say anything that will upset the Iowa farmers. And I said, I got it, I got it. And he said, you know, David is a mother hen. He's going to repeat the same thing to you, but I'm just letting you know what he's going to call you about. About an hour later, David called me and said the same thing. We're going to Iowa right after the announcement, and we don't want to upset the Iowa folks. Is there any way you can work into your invocation something about how egalitarian Barack is, and how he reaches out to people of all ethnic groups? And I said, I got it. I got it. Then, half an hour later, the phone rings again, Wright went on. It's Barack, and he said, Rev, Rolling Stone's gotten a hold of one of your sermons, and they've already given it out to the Hillary people, and it's a big mess. And you know, you can be over the top at times, and David thinks it's best that you don't do the invocation tomorrow. You're going to become the media focus, and all the attention will be deflected away from my announcing my candidacy. So we're asking that you don't do that. But I have two other requests to make of you. And I said, what are those? He said, number one, I really want you to be here in Springfield, and I want you to come and pray privately with Michelle, the kids, and me. Number two, I want my church represented, because my church means a lot to me. So I want Pastor Otis Moss, Wright's chosen successor at Trinity United Church of Christ, to do the invocation. I said, well, okay, let me give you his cell phone number. After Barack hung up, I called Otis and said, man, I just gave your private cell number to Senator Obama because Rolling Stone got a hold of some sermon that they're going to make a big issue out of, and Barack doesn't want me in front of the public eye. Actually, it's David Axelrod who doesn't want me in front of the cameras. But Barack wants his church to be represented, and he's going to call you and ask you to come for the invocation. And Otis said, wait a minute, Eric Whitaker has already called me. Dr. Eric Whitaker, the associate dean and vice president of the University of Chicago Medical Center, was a member of Obama's tight-knit circle of friends. While Whitaker was Illinois health chief, he got caught up in a scandal involving the political fixer Tony Rezko, who was subsequently sent to jail. Whitaker, who was never formally charged with any wrongdoing, traveled with Obama on his campaign plane, played basketball with him, and, unbeknownst to the press corps, secretly handled some of Obama's stickiest personal problems. It was only natural that Obama would turn to Whitaker, a member of Trinity United Church of Christ, to deal with their irascible minister. Otis said Eric Whitaker had already called him and tried to persuade him to go to Springfield and deliver the invocation, Wright told me. Otis was very upset. Reverend, he said, I feel I'm being used. They're trying to drive a wedge between us, and I'm not going to do that unless you give me a direct order. I'm not going down to Springfield. You've been his pastor. I just got here. He doesn't even know me. I'm not going to do that. In the end, Otis Moss relented and delivered the invocation. In the week that followed, Father Michael Flager, the bomb-throwing pastor of St. Sabina's Roman Catholic Church on Chicago's South Side, came to Wright's defense and publicly attacked Eric Whitaker from the pulpit of Trinity United Church of Christ. Footnote. Until their falling out, Father Flager had been extremely close to Obama and had encouraged Obama's belief in his God-given destiny. When Barack was thinking of running for president, Flager told me in an interview for this book, I said to him, if you really believe that God is calling you to do this, forget all the norms. And don't forget that the only way this can happen is through God. If you believe God is calling you, do it. But don't forget, if you get it, don't forget it was God first, not people who got you there. And Barack said to me, yes, Father, I really believe that my plan in life is to go and become president, and that God has called me to go now. Obama called Wright to complain. Do you know what it's like being attacked by my own church? he told Wright and his daughter Jerry, who was also on the phone. Why are your people disrespecting my daddy, who's the pastor of that church? Jerry Wright shot back. You called Daddy and asked him if it would be all right if Otis gave the invocation, but Eric Whitaker had already made the invitation. I didn't know that, Obama said. Well, you need to talk to Eric, Jerry said. David Remnick captured the bitter atmosphere created by this blow-up in his book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. And so, poisonous seeds had been planted, Remnick wrote. The Rolling Stone article, one would have guessed, would surely inspire a foot race among media outlets and opposition researchers to comb through all of Wright's sermons of the past 35 years. David Remnick's guess turned out to be wrong. Media outlets did not engage in a race to follow up on the explosive Jeremiah Wright story. For more than a year, the media ignored the story. Liberal journalists didn't want to rock the boat or do anything to stand in the way of Barack Obama's becoming America's first black president. One could only imagine how these journalists would have behaved if the shoe had been on the other foot and the liberals' bugaboo, President George W. Bush, had sat for 20 years in a white supremacist church and listened to anti-black rants. Never in my memory were so many journalists so intent on effecting liberal change as they were during the campaign of 2008, wrote Bernard Goldberg in his best-selling book, A Slobbering Love Affair, The True and Pathetic Story of the Torrid Romance Between Barack Obama and the Mainstream Media. Sure, Goldberg continued, mainstream journalists always root for the Democrat. But this time it was different. This time journalists were not satisfied merely being partisan witnesses to history. This time they wanted to be real players and determine the outcome. This time they were on a mission, a noble historic mission as far as they were concerned. In fact, I could not remember a time when so many supposedly objective reporters had acted so blatantly as full-fledged advocates for one side, and without even a hint of embarrassment. Then, on March 13, 2008, during the height of the primary battle between Obama and Hillary Clinton, Brian Ross, the chief investigative correspondent of ABC News, broke the media's gentleman's agreement and broadcast videotapes of Wright's sermons. I was surprised that no one else had picked up on the Jeremiah Wright story and pursued the videotapes, Ross said in an interview for this book. I assumed that the Clinton people would have been after the tapes, but they weren't. They were pushing the Tony Rezko scandal with the media. And not everybody at ABC News was thrilled that I ran with the story. People who liked Obama were not happy with me. In fact, my story ran on Good Morning America, but was never picked up by World News Tonight. In one particularly damaging sermon broadcast by ABC, Wright fulminated against the treatment of African Americans. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes the three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America. No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. In another sermon, which Wright delivered on the Sunday after the September 11th terrorist attacks, he charged that Al-Qaeda's assaults were the result of America's imperialist foreign policy. We bombed Hiroshima, we bombed Nagasaki, and we nuked far more than the thousands in New York and the Pentagon, and we never batted an eye. We have supported state terrorism against the Palestinians and black South Africans, and now we are indignant because the stuff we have done overseas is now brought right back into our own front yards. America's chickens are coming home to roost. Man, the media ate me alive, Wright told me when we met in his office at the Kwame Nkrumah Academy. After the media went ballistic on me, I received an email offering me money not to preach at all until the November presidential election. Who sent the email? I asked Wright. It was from one of Barack's closest friends. Who? He named him. He offered you money? Not directly, Wright said. He sent the offer to one of the members of the church, who sent it to me. How much money did he offer you? $150,000, Wright said. What did Obama do? He sent me a text wishing me Happy Easter, which fell that year on March 23rd, 10 days after the ABC News broadcast. And he sent Joshua Dubois, the director of his religious outreach program, to see me. And when Dubois came to Chicago, he didn't know Adam's house cat from Occam's razor. He spent all day with me trying to figure out what we were going to do next. Did Obama himself ever make an effort to see you? Yes, Wright said. Barack said he wanted to meet me in secret, in a secure place. And I said, you're used to coming to my home, you've been here countless times, so what's wrong with coming to my home? So we met in the living room of the parsonage of Trinity United Church of Christ at South Pleasant Avenue, right off 95th Street, just Barack and me. I don't know if he had a wire on him. His security was outside somewhere. And one of the first things Barack said was, I really wish you wouldn't do any more public speaking until after the November election. He knew I had some speaking engagements lined up, and he said, I wish you wouldn't speak at the NAACP Freedom Fund dinner and not do the National Press Club appearance. It's going to hurt the campaign if you do that. And what did you say? I asked. I said, I don't see it that way. And anyway, how am I supposed to support my family? I have a daughter and granddaughter in college whose tuitions I pay. I've got to earn money. And he said, well, I wish you wouldn't speak in public. The press is going to eat you alive. How did you two leave each other that day in your living room? I asked. Barack said, I'm sorry you don't see it the way I do. Do you know what your problem is? And I said, no, what's my problem? And he said, you have to tell the truth. I said, that's a good problem to have. That's a good problem for all preachers to have. That's why I could never be a politician. And he said, it's going to get worse if you go out there and speak. It's really going to get worse. And he was so right. Part 2. Amateur Hour at the White House. If I win the presidency, what advice can you guys give me? Obama queried. Former White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles cut right to the chase. Leave your friends at home, he said. They just create problems when you get to Washington. Valerie Jarrett and David Axelrod looked on, dumbfounded. Ron Suskind, Confidence Men. Chapter 6. Drinking the Obama Kool-Aid. That fellow seems to me to possess but one idea, and that is a wrong one. Samuel Johnson, Boswell's Life of Johnson. On the evening of Tuesday, June 30th, 2009, Barack Obama invited 9 like-minded liberal historians to have dinner with him in the family quarters of the White House. His chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, personally delivered the invitations to each historian with a word of caution. The dinner was to remain private and off the record. All 9 eagerly accepted the invitation, and at the appointed hour they gathered for drinks and hors d'oeuvres in a room decorated with African art, which Barack and Michelle Obama had brought with them to the White House from their home in the Hyde Park section of Chicago. After a while, an usher announced that dinner was being served, and the president led the historians into the dining room, where they hunted for their place cards around a long oval table. The president sat in the middle on one side of the table. 2 of his aides, Rahm Emanuel and Valerie Jarrett, the president's powerful behind-the-scenes senior advisor, had been invited to attend, rounding out the number of diners to 12. At the time of this dinner, Barack Obama was still enjoying a honeymoon period with the American people. According to the most recent Gallup poll, 63% of Americans approved of the job he was doing. Not surprisingly, he was in an expansive mood as he tucked into his lamb chops and went around the table questioning each historian by name: Doris Kearns Goodwin, Michael Beschloss, Robert Caro, Robert Dalek, David Brinkley, H.W. Brands, David Kennedy, Kenneth Mack, and Gary Wills. During the presidential campaign, most of the evening's dinner guests had dropped any pretense at historical objectivity. Upon first meeting candidate Obama, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the author of Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, felt she was in the presence of someone with a really spacious intellect. And Michael Beschloss, Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America, 1789 to 1989, described Obama as probably the smartest guy ever to become president, which appeared to put Thomas Jefferson in his place. Like their liberal counterparts in academia, the media, the mainstream churches, and the entertainment industry, the historians had drunk deeply of the Obama Kool-Aid. Judging from Obama's questions, one subject was foremost in his mind. How could he become a transformational president and change the historic trajectory of America's domestic and foreign policy? Despite his woeful lack of experience, he believed he could pull off this formidable feat. In fact, shortly after he won the presidential election, but before he took office, he had confided to David Axelrod, his chief political strategist, "The weird thing is, I know I can do this job. I like dealing with complicated issues. I'm happy to make decisions. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be an easier adjustment for me than the campaign. Much easier." Tonight, in front of 9 prominent American historians, Obama wasn't shy about flaunting his famous self-confidence. He intended to bring the Israelis and Palestinians to the negotiating table and create a permanent peace in the Middle East. He would open a constructive dialogue with America's enemies in Iran and North Korea and, through his powers of persuasion, help them see the error of their ways. He'd pass legislation in Washington to revolutionize the country's healthcare system and energy policy. And he'd inject the regulatory hand of the federal government into the American economy in an effort to create a more just and equitable society. When several of the historians brought up the difficulties that Lyndon Johnson had faced trying to wage a foreign war while implementing an ambitious domestic agenda, Obama grew testy. He knew better. He could prevail by the force of his personality. He could solve the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, put millions of people back to work, redistribute wealth, withdraw from Iraq, and reconcile the United States to a less dominant role in the world. It was, by any measure, a breathtaking display of narcissistic grandiosity from a man whose entire political curriculum vitae consisted of 7 undistinguished years in the Illinois Senate, 2 mostly absent years in the United States Senate, and 5 months and 10 days in the White House. Unintentionally, Obama revealed the characteristics that made him totally unsuited for the presidency and that would doom him to failure. His extreme haughtiness and excessive pride. His ideological bent as a far-left corporatist. And his astounding amateurism. These characteristics had already set the pattern of his presidency. He conducted his own foreign policy more than any previous president, including Richard Nixon. He made all the decisions because he believed that only he understood the issues. He spent his evenings writing decision papers on foreign affairs when, instead, he should have delegated that chore to experts and devoted his time to befriending members of Congress in order to get his bills passed. He still loved making speeches to large, adoring crowds, but he complained to foreign leaders on the QT that he had to waste precious hours talking with congressmen from Palookaville. In meetings with his cabinet and national security team, he acted as though he was the smartest person in the room, which didn't encourage people to speak their minds. He rarely bothered to pick up the phone and seek the advice of outside experts. And he never called the people who had brought him to the dance. Those who backed his presidential bid with their money, time, and organizational skills. The Kennedys didn't hear from him. Oprah Winfrey didn't hear from him. Wealthy Jewish donors in Chicago who had helped fund his 2008 campaign didn't hear from him. The First Day people, African-American leaders in Chicago who had paved the way for his political ascent, never heard from him either. The senior people in his administration proved to be just as inexperienced and inept as Obama when it came to the business of running the government. Members of his inner circle, David Axelrod, campaign manager David Plouffe, press secretary Robert Gibbs, and éminence grise Valerie Jarrett, had proven their mettle in the dark arts of political campaigning, but they had no serious experience in dealing with public policy issues. If they could be said to have any policy exposure at all, it was their ideological enthusiasms for the left. What's more, the members of Obama's inner circle didn't treat him as the most important politician in America, which he was by virtue of occupying the Oval Office. After all, politician was a dirty word in Obama world. Instead, they treated Obama as though he was a movie star, or the heavyweight champion of the world, a political Muhammad Ali who never tired of hearing that he was the greatest. He is the living, breathing apotheosis of the American melting pot, enthused David Axelrod, who privately coined a nickname for his boss, Black Jesus. The one discordant note in this chorus of hosannas came from Obama's hard-as-nails chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, a professional Paul who in years to come would privately confess, "I whipped ass up and down, front room and back room, and I got sick and tired of the White House. I got sick of fighting and losing in the White House, and I was eager to leave." Over the two-hour dinner, Obama and the historians discussed several past presidents. It wasn't clear from Obama's responses which of those presidents he identified with. At one point, Obama seemed to channel the charismatic John F. Kennedy. At another moment, he extolled the virtues of the transformative Ronald Reagan. Then again, it was the saintly Lincoln, or the New Deal's happy warrior, Franklin Roosevelt, or... In the words of Victor Davis Hanson, who, like other conservative historians, had not been invited to attend the dinner, the new president seemed to be looking for a presidential identity not his own, endlessly trying on new presidential masks. Obama told the historians at the table that he had come up with a slogan for his administration. "I'm thinking of calling it a new foundation," he said. Doris Kearns Goodwin suggested that a new foundation might not be the wisest choice for a motto. "Why not?" the president asked. "It sounds," said Goodwin, "like a woman's girdle." If the meeting proved anything, it was that Barack Obama didn't have the faintest idea, one, who he was, two, why he had been elected president, and three, how to be the commander-in-chief and chief executive of the United States of America. In short, he didn't know what he didn't know. He believed, wrongly, that his so-called personal narrative had gotten him elected. Even as president, he never tired of telling the same old stories, more myth than reality, about his idealistic white mother and brilliant African father, his American-as-apple-pie white grandparents, Gramps and Toot, his cockeyed Indonesian stepfather, Lolo Setoro, and his transformation from a confused young man of mixed race named Barry to a proud African-American adult named Barack Hussein Obama. He further believed, wrongly, that he was not only a different kind of leader by virtue of his race, strange name, and exotic upbringing, but that he was a child of destiny, a special person who had been singled out for great things. In his mind, he had been elected to be a transformational president and to save America from itself. None of this was true. Barack Obama wasn't elected because of his charisma and biography. And he certainly wasn't elected to turn America into a European-style quasi-socialist country in which the state controls economic and social matters. The political stars had aligned for him in the election year of 2008 because the American people were scared to death about the economy, fed up with George W. Bush and the spendthrift Republicans, disillusioned by the seemingly endless war in Iraq, and sick at heart over the decline of their society's values. But Obama couldn't see any of that. He was blind to reality because he suffered from what could only be described as a messianic complex, meaning that he believed he was destined to become America's savior. "My attitude is that you don't want to just be the president," Obama told an interviewer for Men's Vogue. "You want to change the country." For a long time, people didn't understand that there was a method in his madness. As Shelby Steele, a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, pointed out, "Among today's liberal elite, bad faith in America is a sophistication, a kind of hipness. More importantly, it is the perfect formula for political and government power. It rationalizes power in the name of intervening against evil. I will use the government to intervene against the evil tendencies of American life, economic inequality, structural racism and sexism, corporate greed, neglect of the environment, and so on." Obama's acolytes in academia, the media, the churches, and the world of entertainment encourage this dangerous delusion. Micah Tillman, a lecturer in philosophy at the Catholic University of America, said, "Barack Obama is the Platonic philosopher king we've been looking for the past 2,400 years. At a campaign rally in South Carolina, Oprah Winfrey had referred to Obama as the One, a reference to both Jesus Christ and Neo from the movie The Matrix. The New York Times called his election a national catharsis. His hometown newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times, wrote, "The first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review has a movie star smile and more than a little mystique. Also, we just like to say his name. We are considering taking it as a mantra." Obama's political apostles never seemed to tire of coming up with fresh examples of his divinity. Some examples. MSNBC's Chris Matthews. "I've been following politics since I was about 5. I've never seen anything like this. This is bigger than Kennedy. Obama comes along, and he seems to have the answers. This is the New Testament." Newsweek editor Evan Thomas. "In a way, Obama is standing above the country, above the world. He's sort of God. He's going to bring all the different sides together." Film director Spike Lee. "You'll have to measure time by before Obama and after Obama. Everything's going to be affected by this seismic change in the universe." Jonathan Alter in his book, The Promise, President Obama Year One. Rabbi David Saperstein, reading from Psalms in English and Hebrew, noticed from the Alter that the good men and women of the congregation that day, including the Bidens and other dignitaries, had not yet stood. Finally, Bishop Vashti McKenzie of the African Methodist Church asked that everyone rise. At that moment, Saperstein saw something from his angle of vision. "If I had seen it in a movie, I would have groaned and said, 'Give me a break. That's so trite.' A beam of morning light shone through the stained glass windows and illuminated the president-elect's face. Several of the clergy and choir on the altar who also saw it marveled afterward about the presence of the divine." The absurd, not to say blasphemous, comparison of Obama to the Almighty became so embarrassing that Vice President Joe Biden couldn't resist the opportunity to tease the president about his Messiah complex. speaking at the 2009 White Tie Gridiron Club dinner, Biden said, "President Obama can't be here tonight because he's busy getting ready for Easter. He thinks it's about him." During his dinner with the historians, Obama indicated that he had a preference for a corporatist political system in which the economy would be collectively managed by big employers, big unions, and government officials through a formal mechanism at the national level. Also known as state capitalism, it is a system in which the government picks winners and promotes economic growth. This corporatist approach was hardly a new idea. It had been around for more than 150 years. It had been tried in the 1930s and 1940s by Benito Mussolini's Italian fascists, and in Europe after World War II by democratic socialist governments in Greece, Italy, Spain, and Portugal, among others. In America, during the 1970s and 1980s, left-wing Democratic presidential candidates Gary Hart and Michael Dukakis revived the idea, arguing that America should replace free market capitalism with what they called a neo-corporatist state. Though the corporatist idea had an unbroken record of failure, both in Europe and America, where voters had decisively rejected Gary Hart and Michael Dukakis, Obama was determined to embrace this discredited economic, political, and social philosophy. He planned to achieve his transformational presidency by vastly expanding the reach of Washington into the everyday life of American citizens. In that regard, the American president whom Obama most closely resembled was not JFK, Reagan, Lincoln, or Franklin Roosevelt. It was Woodrow Wilson, whose conception of himself was aptly described by the noted conservative historian Forrest MacDonald, also missing at the White House dinner, as little short of messianic. Indeed, MacDonald wrote about Wilson. The day after his election, the Democratic national chairman called on him to confer about appointments, only to be rebuffed by Wilson's statement, "Before we proceed, I wish it clearly understood that I owe you nothing. Remember that God ordained that I should be the next president of the United States." He was a master of oratory who described every issue, no matter how trivial, in terms of a great moral crusade, always with himself as the nation's, and later the world's, moral leader. And he believed what he was saying. Given this attitude, it followed that people who opposed him were unenlightened or evil. It was therefore impossible to meet them halfway. Forrest MacDonald's description of Woodrow Wilson captures Barack Obama to a T. In the fall of 2011, shortly after Obama botched the budget deficit negotiations with Congress, and the United States government lost its AAA credit rating for the first time in history, I met under hush-hush conditions with one of the historians who had dined at the White House with Obama during the infancy of his presidency. We met in a restaurant on the outskirts of a large American city, where we were unlikely to be seen. Our conversation, which lasted for nearly 2 hours, was conducted under the condition of anonymity. I wanted to know how this historian, who had once drunk the Obama Kool-Aid, matched the president's promise with his performance. By this time, most of Obama's supporters were puzzled by a sense of disconnect between the strictly on-message presidential candidate and the president who was adrift and elusive. The satirical TV show The Onion News Network broadcast a faux story that the real Barack Obama had been kidnapped just hours after the election and replaced by an imposter. Disillusioned liberals viewed Obama as a failed messiah. But conservatives had never fallen for the messianic talk. To conservatives, Obama's problems stemmed less from his inflated self-image than from his unmitigated incompetence. He was the community organizer who had never held a real job and had brought the country to the brink of ruin because of his callow understanding of the way the world worked. I wondered if the historian I met at the deli agreed with this assessment. There's no doubt that Obama has turned out to be a major enigma and disappointment, the historian admitted. He waged such a brilliant campaign, first against Hillary Clinton in the primaries, then against John McCain in the general election. For a long time, I found it hard to understand why he couldn't translate his political savvy into effective governance. But I think I know the answer now, the historian continued. Since the beginning of his administration, Obama hasn't been able to capture the public's imagination and inspire people to follow him. Vision isn't enough in a president. Great presidents not only have to enunciate their vision, they must lead by example and inspiration. Franklin Roosevelt spoke to the individual. He and Ronald Reagan had the ability to make each American feel that the president cared deeply and personally about them. That quality has been lacking in Obama. People don't feel that he's on their side. The irony is that he was supposed to be such a brilliant orator, but in fact, he's turned out to be a failure as a communicator. And his failure to connect with people has had nothing to do with the choice of his words or how well he delivers his speeches. It's something much more fundamental than that. The American people have come to realize that, in Barack Obama, they elected a man as president who does not know how to lead. He lacks an executive sense. He doesn't know how to run things. He's not a manager. He hasn't been able to bring together the best and brightest talents. Not to put too fine a point on it, he's in over his head. Chapter 7. Bungler in Chief. Obama's Nobel Peace Prize would be like giving someone an Oscar in the hope that it would encourage them to make a decent motion picture. Christopher Hitchens. Calling Barack Obama an amateur can be tricky business. After all, amateurs are often viewed in a positive light. In fiction, Agatha Christie's Miss Marple is an amateur detective, and the foppish young English nobleman, Sir Percy Blakeney, turns out to be the dashing Scarlet Pimpernel. In real life, two of history's greatest scientists, Charles Darwin and Gregor Mendel, were amateurs. So was the great golfer Bobby Jones. And who can forget the finest amateur boxer of all time, Cassius Clay, who won the light heavyweight gold medal at the 1960 Summer Olympics before he turned professional as Muhammad Ali. Obama would appear to be the polar opposite of the amateur who does what he does for the pure pleasure of it. No matter how much Obama likes to parade as a nonpartisan reformer, he is, in fact, the product of Chicago-style politics, which is a byword for patronage, nepotism, bribery, and corruption. Since 1972, four Illinois governors out of seven have been convicted of corruption. A new report documents the extent to which the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago have been hotbeds of corruption, reports the February 25, 2012 issue of The Economist. Chicago has the dubious distinction of being the federal district with the most convictions since 1976. Since then, 1,828 elected officials, appointees, government employees, and a few private individuals have been convicted of corruption in Illinois, and 84% of these were in its northern district, a judicial zone which contains the entire Chicago metropolitan area. During this time, around one-third of the city's aldermen have been convicted of corruption. No mayors have been convicted or indicted, not even Bill Thompson, who is backed by Al Capone. Chicago is where Obama cut his political teeth. His wife Michelle worked for Mayor Daley's political machine, as did his senior advisor, Valerie Jarrett. Obama and his crew of Chicago operatives don't abide by the Marquis of Queensbury rules of political combat. As Sean Connery memorably said of The Chicago Way in the movie The Untouchables, he brings a knife to the fight, you bring a gun. He puts one of yours in the hospital, you put one of his in the morgue. If we have learned anything about Barack Obama the past 3 years, it's that he enjoys hitting, columnist Daniel Henninger wrote in the Wall Street Journal. He will be merciless with the Republican nominee. Ask Hillary. Ask the respectful Republicans that Obama has pistol-whipped. Ask Wall Street's Democrats. So what do I mean when I call such a bare-knuckled political warrior an amateur? I simply mean this. Judged by the skill set that is necessary for the chief executive and commander-in-chief of the United States of America, Obama is the bungler-in-chief. Obama has a political sense, but he lacks an executive sense, says Walter Anderson, a leadership expert whose lectures at the New School for Social Research in New York City were turned into a best-selling book, The Confidence Course. He has the same vulnerability that many legislators have. He's skillful at getting elected, but he's often lost when it comes to governing and inspiring others. In my view, it's a mistake to compare Obama to Jimmy Carter, as some do. Carter was a micromanager in all things. Obama is anything but. Obama is politically astute, says Tavis Smiley, the African-American talk show host who has often criticized Obama. I was in awe of how well-run and on-message his presidential campaign was. In all my life, I never saw a campaign run so brilliantly. And so it's been interesting to see how off-course and off-track Obama has gotten in the White House. And what's occurred to me is that campaigning and governing are entirely different things, and that all the things that served Obama so well in the campaign have come back to haunt him in his governance. William Safire, the late New York Times columnist and lexicographer, might have had Barack Obama in mind when he noted in Safire's Political Dictionary, "Because there are a great many more amateurs than pros, the public image of the amateur is that of a fresh-faced, civic-minded citizen out to do battle for a cause he believes in, versus the cigar-chomping image of the political professional. The appearance of being an amateur, then, is something to be coveted. The act of doing political work amateurishly is something to be avoided." Obama has cultivated the appearance of being a political amateur. He likes to be seen as above the fray. He hates to be seen getting his hands dirty in the nitty-gritty of politics. During his presidency, he has rarely appeared at the Democratic Party's most important annual event, the Jefferson Jackson Day fundraising dinner. He lets others in the White House deconstruct polling data and analyze electoral maps, because he thinks that such behavior is beneath him. And he refuses to make robocalls, recorded phone messages asking people to go out and vote. Obama does little to disguise his disdain for Washington and the conventions of modern politics, writes the New York Times' Peter Baker, the author of a book on the impeachment of Bill Clinton. "When he emerges from the Oval Office during the day," aides say, "he sometimes pauses before the split-screen television in the outer reception area, soaks in the cable chatter, then shakes his head and walks away. He's still never gotten comfortable here," a top White House official told me. "He has little patience for what Valerie Jarrett, a senior advisor, calls the inevitable theatrics of Washington. He has yet to fully decide whether he is of Washington or apart from it." Obama's consigliere, Valerie Jarrett, is even blunter about it. She told New Yorker editor David Remnick that Obama was just too talented to do what ordinary people do. All of this helps explain why Obama bungled last year's deliberations by the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, otherwise known as the Super Committee. A Ronald Reagan or a Bill Clinton would have been much more effectively engaged in twisting arms and, where necessary, dispensing favors, wrote The Economist. Obama's detachment from the political battle, the British magazine went on to say, should not have been surprising, given his lamentable failure a year ago to endorse the effective and brave conclusions of the Bowles-Simpson Deficit Commission that he personally appointed. Obama's arrogance, his sense of superiority, and his air of haughtiness, but above all, his amateurism, are responsible for his record of political fiascos. 2 days after his inauguration, he overruled his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, and signed orders saying that the prison camp at Guantanamo Bay would be closed within a year. At the time of the signing, he didn't have the faintest idea where he would put the terrorists. It turned out that nobody in America wanted terrorists in their backyard, and so, nearly 4 years later, most of them are still there, in Gitmo. Again, against the advice of Rahm Emanuel, Obama supported Attorney General Eric Holder's harebrained scheme to send Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the September 11th terrorist attacks, to New York City to stand trial in a civilian court, not far from the site of the ruins of the World Trade Center. Ultimately, Obama had to abandon the notion of trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as a civilian. Democratic political strategist James Carville, a native of Louisiana, lambasted Obama for the political stupidity of his response to the calamitous oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. "The president doesn't get down here in the middle of this," Carville said. "I have no idea of why they, the White House, didn't seize this thing. I have no idea of why their attitude was so hands-off here. The president of the United States could have come down here. He could have been involved with the families of these 11 people who died in the explosion. He could have demanded a plan in anticipation of this. It just looks like he's not involved in this. Man, you got to get down here and take control of this." Obama's view of himself as a superior human being, who isn't bound by the same rules as other politicians, has frequently gotten him into hot water. While campaigning for the presidency, he refused to wear a flag pin, as though he agreed with Samuel Johnson's supercilious remark that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. When his missing flag pin became an issue in the campaign, he started wearing one. After he won the White House, his failure to attend church services resurrected old questions about whether he was a Christian. To tamp down the criticism, he started showing up at church services near the White House, making sure there were photographers on hand to record his pious devotions. But to a remarkable degree, Obama has compounded his amateurism by failing to learn from his mistakes and correct them. Case in point, when the president campaigned for the 2009 stimulus package at the start of his presidency, he promised that large chunks of the money would go to shovel-ready projects. 2 years after he signed the $800 billion package, a shame-faced Obama acknowledged, "There's no such thing as shovel-ready projects." Yet, though the initial stimulus was a flop, that didn't stop Obama from going back to Congress to ask for more money, a budget-busting $450 billion. Another case in point. In September 2011, Obama decided he wanted to address a joint session of Congress in order to lay out his agenda on job creation. Trouble was, no one in the clueless Obama White House realized that Congress wasn't in session, and that the president's choice of date fell on the same evening as a planned Republican presidential debate. The president was forced to accept another date and time, which turned out to be just as embarrassing, because it conflicted with the regular NFL season opener between the Green Bay Packers and the New Orleans Saints. Obama's most glaring political error was to make a massive overhaul of the nation's healthcare system his first priority, instead of concentrating, as he should have, on the economy and jobs. Early on, Emanuel argued for a smaller bill with popular items, such as expanding health coverage for children and young adults, that could win some Republican support, noted Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank. He opposed the public option as a needless distraction. The president disregarded that strategy and sided with Capitol Hill liberals who hoped to ram a larger, less popular bill through Congress with Democratic votes only. The result was, as the world now knows, disastrous. Footnote: when Obama overruled Emanuel on health care, he told him, I wasn't sent here to do school uniforms. What's more, even after Obama got his signature health care bill passed by Congress, he never found a way to sell it to the American people. It was as if he was more interested in having a signing ceremony than in what he signed. To me, said a former staff director of a major Senate committee, that signals inexperience, because as president, Obama has not managed to get any benefit from the major piece of legislation that he's passed. It's almost as though he doesn't want to talk about it. He's not out there touting these things because he's not sure how he really feels about them. From my experience dealing with the White House, I'm not convinced that Obama's wedded to these programs. Leaving aside the campaign rhetoric, giving hope a chance and all that stuff, what will Obama bleed for? What will he go to the mat for? What does this guy believe in his core? At the beginning of 2012, just as the limping American economy started to show some signs of movement, and Obama's poll ratings began to stir, he stepped in deep doo-doo again. This time, he announced that all religious-affiliated institutions would be required to pay for insurance that covered birth control, including contraception. As could have been predicted, there was an instant backlash from the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, as well as from both conservative and liberal-leaning Catholics. Even Obama's true believers found it hard to comprehend the president's amateurish decision, which stomped on the religious liberty clause of the First Amendment. Hardball's liberal chatterbox, Chris Matthews, called it frightening, and Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne, an ardent Obama loyalist, wrote that Obama had utterly botched the issue. That Obama could so completely misread the public mood was nothing new. It recalled the time during the 2008 presidential campaign when he criticized white working-class voters in Pennsylvania and the Midwest for clinging to guns or religion. After Hillary Clinton jumped on him for those comments, saying, "The people of faith I know don't cling to religion because they are materially poor, but because they are spiritually rich," Obama was forced to apologize and eat crow. And that's exactly what happened with his regulation requiring religious-affiliated institutions to provide birth control insurance. In the midst of the firestorm of criticism, he called a press conference and, looking glum and sounding resentful, announced a policy to quiet his critics. Under the new policy, health insurance companies, not religious employers, would pay for contraceptives. To many conservatives, it was a distinction without a difference. Obama had only made matters worse. "Insurance companies won't be making donations," editorialized the Wall Street Journal. "Drug makers will still charge for the pill. Doctors will still bill for reproductive treatment. The reality, as with all mandated benefits, is that these costs will be borne eventually via higher premiums. The balloon may be squeezed differently over time, and insurers may amortize the cost differently over time. But eventually, prices will find an equilibrium. Notre Dame will still pay for birth control, even if it is nominally carried by a third-party corporation." Chapter 8. Clark Kent. With all of Obama's rhetorical brilliance and flash, he went into the phone booth as Superman and came out as Clark Kent. Presidential historian Fred I. Greenstein. To put all this in perspective, I asked former Secretary of State James Baker, who served as chief of staff in President Reagan's first administration, how he would rate Obama's performance. The conditions under which Barack Obama and Ronald Reagan came to power are startlingly similar, said Baker, who is widely regarded as the most effective chief of staff in modern presidential history. Both inherited a terrible economic situation, but Reagan set about focusing with laser-like intensity on economic issues. Then Secretary of State Al Haig wanted to take some action in the Caribbean while we were trying to focus entirely on the economy, and we shut him down. By contrast, Obama didn't focus on the big problem of the economy. He didn't even draft his own stimulus package. He subcontracted it out to the Democrats in Congress. Immediately after the drubbing Obama took in the 2010 midterm elections, Baker continued, I was asked to come to Washington to meet with him. His secretary called my office to set up a time. Then I got a call from Chief of Staff Bill Daley. I understand you're going to meet with the president, Daley told me. Would you stop by and meet with me afterward? Then I got another call, this one from National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, who said the same thing as Daley. In the Reagan administration, we would never have scheduled a meeting with the president that the Chief of Staff and the National Security Advisor found out about later. All this comes from the fact that, before he became president, Obama never had the responsibility for running anything. He's a policy wonk. He's very smart, very knowledgeable. But he was a community organizer. And a community organizer doesn't have the lines of authority that you have when you're running an organization. Obama's handling of the 2009 fiscal crisis showed an alarming lack of experience and a complete ignorance of how Washington works. For instance, during the presidential race, Obama campaigned against earmarks, the notorious legislative gimmick used by congressmen and senators to allocate funds for favorite projects in their home districts. Yet, when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid sent an omnibus spending bill with $8 billion worth of earmarks to the White House, Obama naively believed Pelosi and Reid, who told him that that was the only way he could get his $800 billion stimulus bill passed. Obama signed the omnibus spending bill with all the earmarks intact, signaling that the barons of Capitol Hill could roll the amateurish president. For a long time, some people, especially those in the liberal mainstream media, thought that Obama would somehow make up for what he lacked in experience with his oratorical skills. Liberals considered Obama to be a great communicator, right up there with such masters as Franklin Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton. Not anymore. Most of his recent speeches have fallen flat. Americans have tuned him out. His 2012 State of the Union address was seen by 37.8 million television viewers, down from the 52.3 million people who tuned in to his first address to Congress in 2009. As Maureen Dowd noted in the New York Times, Bill Clinton will often forcefully and feelingly frame the argument for Obama policies in a way that Obama himself, once hailed as a master communicator, can't seem to muster. Other presidents have entered the White House as amateurs. John F. Kennedy immediately comes to mind. JFK stumbled badly during his first year in office. The Bay of Pigs calamity was only the most notable of his many mistakes. But he grew in the job and was well on his way to becoming an effective chief executive when he was cut down by an assassin's bullet in Dallas. So why hasn't Obama grown in the job? There are several answers to that question, which we will explore in depth in the pages that follow. But for now, the short answer is, Barack Obama has the wrong temperament for the presidency. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. famously said about Franklin Roosevelt that he had a second-class mind, but a first-class temperament. The opposite is true of Barack Obama, who, for all his academic credentials, is not cut out by temperament to be the leader of the free world. By all accounts, Obama was elected to a job for which he has little relish. He doesn't find joy in being president. Like Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter, he is an introvert who prefers his own company to that of others. The Times' Peter Baker puts it this way. Obama is someone who finds extended contact with groups of people outside his immediate circle to be draining. He can rouse a stadium of 80,000 people, but that audience is an impersonal monolith. Smaller group settings can be harder for him. While Bill Clinton made late-night phone calls around Washington to vent or seek advice, Obama rarely reaches outside the tight groups of